Good morning and welcome
Blog
to Wanda
Talk
Sings.
Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Ticks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Today we are going to be speaking to the sister of Kayla or Xavier Moore, who was killed by the Berkeley police just a year ago. And there is going to be a vigil at the Gaia Building, 2116 Alston Way, today at 6 p.m. And then there's going to be a speak out at the Police Review Commission meeting at the South Berkeley Senior Center at 2939 Ellis Street off of Ashby. So tune in. We're going to be speaking to Kayla or Xavier, the victim. We're going to be speaking to her sister, Maria, in the second half of the program. Today is also Lincoln's birthday, and Lincoln is the president who issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which told the Confederacy that if they didn't agree to a union of the nation or United States, that there would be war here. And, of course, the Confederacy refused because they didn't want to give up slavery. And there was a war which lasted for 2 years, from 1863, January 1st, to 1865. There's a whole lot that happened. And at the University of California Berkeley Art Museum, they are currently have a wonderful exhibit there. And it's Barbara Chase Revo's The Malcolm X Steles. And it's up today, the 12th, through April 27th. And it's actually the last exhibit at the museum before it closes, because there's going to be a new exhibit going up. And I had an opportunity to talk with her yesterday and attend a really wonderful reception, preceded by a great conversation last night, and it was just fabulous. Mrs. Chase Revo was born in Philadelphia and educated at the Philadelphia High School for Girls, Temple University Tyler School of Art, and the Yale University School of Design and Architecture. She has lived in Paris since the late 1960s and is an internationally acclaimed visual artist whose widely exhibited work has been seen in solo exhibitions at the Musée d'Art Moderne de Ville de Paris and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, New York. Her group exhibitions at the Whitney Museum of American Art, New York, and the Smithsonian American Art Museum, Washington, D.C., and the Centre Georges Pompidou in Paris, another major arts festival. Her towering public sculpture, Africa Rising, 1998, stands in the African Burial Ground National Monument in Lower Manhattan. She is also an award-winning poet and writer, known for her books of poetry, From Memphis and Peking, 1974, and Portrait of a Nude Woman as Cleopatra in 1988, and the historic novel Sally Hemings, 1979, Echoes of Lions, 1989, and Hottentot Venus, 2003. And in 1996, she was knighted Chevalier des Ordres des Arts et des Lettres. And again, the exhibit is simply fabulous, the Malcolm X Steles. You don't want to miss them. And again, it's up through April 27th. And we're going to be seeing a little bit more about her perhaps later on in the show. And I might play a little bit of our interview. So we're going to start with, we're going to play most, if not all, of an interview that I had with Margaret Avery, who plays Suge in The Color Purple. And I think we just maybe jump right into that. She's going to be here this Friday, V-Day, or Valentine's Day, and also the second installation of 1 billion girls and women rising against violence against women. And last year was the first 1 billion girls rising. And it's an international, worldwide action against violence against women. And it was called, given by Eve Ensler, who wrote, among other things, the Vagina Monologues. And there's going to be a whole lot of activities happening this weekend looking at stopping the violence against women. There's one activity, one event that's going to be happening at the East Oakland Youth Development Center on Saturday, and we're going to be having guests to talk about that on the air on Friday morning. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that a little later in the show, give you all the details on that. So here's an interview that I had about a week or two ago now with Margaret Avery. And it was really, really wonderful.
Thank you so much, Ms. Avery, for the interview. Congratulations on your role as Helen Patterson and being Mary Jane. I'd like to begin our conversation with a look at V-Day, which is February 14th, and 1 Billion Rising, which was kicked off by Eve Ensler last year as a worldwide look at ending violence against women, which ties, I believe, directly into your, you know, the character people know you most by, Shug Avery in Spielberg's adaptation of Alice Walker's book for the screen, The Color Purple. And the example of your character in the film, Shug Avery, set for the character Seeley, portrayed by Whoopi Goldberg. Whoa, what a mouthful, right?
So what is the question?
The question is, I want you to talk about, Valentine's Day, not as a day that you necessarily, you know, expect chocolates, you know, and cards.
Not at my weight, I can't expect chocolates anymore. My metabolism is minus 10, I'm sure. But do you know the history of Valentine's Day? Because I'm not sure. When I was teaching first grade, I knew all these holidays. Mm-hmm. But it escapes me now. But, usually we just talk about it as our loved ones, you know, showing appreciation of one another and romance. And but love can be expressed to many others. I mean, it could be expressed by making a donation to KCET or just to some foundation. But I think it's like, a part of it means giving of oneself and showing appreciation of others or another.
Yeah. Do you know of Eve Ensler's call for addressing violence against women on Valentine's Day? She calls it V-Day, and then last year she called for 1 billion girls and women around the world to rise up against and bring attention to the violence against women, which unfortunately the numbers, you know, are not going down. They're actually going up.
Yeah, and you find that, I think that any time the economy is really bad, you're going to find that people are more stressed and maybe even resorting more to alcohol, because to ease the pain. Our men, so many are coming out who have been incarcerated, and they're coming out with no jobs and not really the support system that they need. And, you know, it's like you get mad at the world or your boss, and you come home and you kick the dog. So a lot of it is, I think, frustration with people. And then it's also environment, how a person grew up. They express themselves physically as opposed to rationally. So, and we have that a lot in our culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as far as the special V-Day for against violence, I think that could be emphasized more. I'm ashamed to say that I'm not really that familiar with it. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly an advocate against violence. And as a matter of fact, I have in the past counseled, because I have a master's in psychology, I've worked with battered women and, mm-hmm. and children. And so it's I'm just amazed that that Los Angeles here, I don't think, is really aware of that, of Valentine's Day being the V Day.
Oh, wow. Oh, that is amazing. You know that you you have a master's in psychology and that so I believe so you are you're a therapist as well.
Well, I used to be until I started getting back into the acting again.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to run that kind of business, and then suddenly you get a film and say, "Oh, to your patients or clients." I'll call you, don't you call me, or put that suicide on hold because, you know, I can't deal with you right now. So
mm-hmm.
I just had to stop it.
Wow, you know, that's really interesting because...
But I have to say this,
mm-hmm.
Whenever people, young people say, what about, you know, how do you survive in acting? I think that it's very rare that anyone has a career that's always visible from the time they begin till the time they end. I mean, there's always those lulls. There were always those times when I said, well, gee, I wonder what happened to so-and-so. I haven't seen her in a long time, or I haven't seen him in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a life, and you have to, for me, I always felt that I needed to have something other than just the business. Because it fluctuates. When you look at the motion picture home, where actors and people in the motion picture industry can go for assisted living or full-time living or the nursing home, and that was kind of put in danger a while back financially, but it's pretty stable now.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that qualify for the home who are in the business are usually the cameramen and production people, not actors. And as it was explained to me, actors sometimes have like 10 years of a great heyday, and then they have a lull. But you have to qualify by having 20 years vested in the business. And most actors don't get 20 years. So when I found out that I had more than 30 years, I was like, whoa, hey, you know, this is, I can say that I'm very blessed. And the woman that I spoke to at the home regarding these requirements, she was just amazed. So after that, after I found out how I had qualified, overly qualified, I said, you know, I don't have to beat myself up anymore because I'm not working or feel guilty that I'm not out there doing things. I can do other things. And that's when I became interested in going back to school. And it was actually for personal growth.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to just learn about why, you know, how my growing up has affected my life. Why was I attracted to the wrong men? And I grew up in an alcoholic home.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets back to what I was saying, how people, their childhood or their environment can influence how they deal with others, conflict resolution. And the growing up in an alcoholic home, I saw that myself. My mother was very violent in her relationships because that's what she grew up doing as a child. She was the oldest of 13, and she protected her brother. She would fight for him, and for in some environments, if you don't fight and stand up to a bully, you're always going to be picked on. So you learn to kick behind and ask questions later. And that carries over. That's got to carry over into your relationship. So I found out a lot of things about myself, and it just made me such a better person. My guy that I'm with now, my God, we've been together 18 years, and I never would have been attracted to him had I not found out about myself and made changes with myself.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this interesting?
Yes, very interesting.
And, I mean, people say, oh, my God, you know, why can't I find a man? Or why do, if you look at a lot of times, I found out it was like 20 years between a relationship that I had with my, between my daughter's father and then another relationship 20 years later. Well, it turned out they were the same men. It was the same kind of choice. They were both had some kind of, and they were abusive to me mentally, not physically. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, I started thinking, well, somebody put a gun to my head to make me choose these two individuals. It's me. There's something about me. I have to change. And like I said, when I went back to school, that's why I say God is so good. I never knew that it would be a school for psychology. It was just, like I said, I just wanted to study something different, just be able to have a conversation other than about the film industry, make myself a little bit more knowledgeable about the world and others. And it turned out to be psychology, and I learned all of this stuff about myself. How you deal with life if you're an only child, how you deal with life if you're in a family, you're the middle child, or you're the oldest child, or the youngest child. There are different dynamics that carry over into your personality and into your adult life. And with me, the choices I made in growing up in an alcoholic home and in a somewhat violent home, that manifests itself into my personality in a relationship of not being able to communicate with my partner well, because I never talked about my feelings or my emotions when I grew up. It's like you just stuff everything. Well, in a relationship, you can't do that. You don't. You've got to be able to talk. Talk about things, and you've got to be able to talk about them before you're ready to just blow up, because then you're like pointing the finger and blaming and cursing and calling a person names. I'm talking about what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, words are so hurtful. And why do we do that? Why was I doing that? Because I was hurt and I'm lashing back. But I'm lashing back because I waited too long to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And let it just build and build and build. So, but anyway, we can talk about something else. The audience is going to say, my God, you know, Jesus.
Yeah, it's just interesting. As I was listening to you, I just saw, you know, some of your characters. you know, I saw this. You know, these various personas, you know, Miss Avery, Miss Avery the person, you know, being externalized in these various characters,
mm-hmm.
You know.
And that's what acting is.
Mm-hmm.
You do bring
mm-hmm.
what's on the page to life, and I think you can't help but bring a part of yourself that you can identify with or relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, not be afraid to show your vulnerability.
Right, yeah. yeah, so let's talk a little bit about what's bringing you to San Francisco on February 14th, which is just a week from now almost, a little bit more than a week, and you're going to be at a special Valentine's Day celebration of The Color Purple, and you are the, you know, sort of the star attraction.
Oh, boy. Yeah, well, Color Purple is a star attraction, I would imagine, and it's at the...
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah, it's at the Castro Theater, yes.
The Castro Theater.
7:30.
Oh, that brings
mm-hmm.
back so much memories from
mm-hmm.
me being, having gone to school at San Francisco State
mm-hmm.
During the Flower Children days, and Castro Street was a big street. In my memories.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the events is going to be there, and once again, we're going to show The Color Purple, and I will be available for Q&A.
Yeah, that's going to be very nice.
The film itself is shown so much on television. I'm just hoping that people are still interested in seeing it. But then there are people who are like in their 30s that have never seen the film.
Mm-hmm.
And can you imagine? It was almost 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing because, you know, it was met with such controversy. I remember there were pickets like, don't go see the film, and, you know, Alice Walker's response to, you know the community's response, African-American community's response to the film, and she hadn't known that it was going to be what it was. The book is not the film. And I certainly encourage people to read the book. However, the film is a real important document.
Well, I always say, Wanda, that the controversy, and it's kind of a complex thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start this way. You know, The Color Purple came out after Sounder, and I think it was like 6 or 7, maybe even 8 years. Remember Sounder?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
With the lovely... Paul Winfield and come on, help me. She's on Broadway now doing the film. I'll think of it in a minute. But anyway, that film was so uplifting to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And now, 6, 7 years later, here comes Color Purple, projecting men as being mean and evil. And so I always say that when you have just one film, people kind of want it to represent them. And this was not a documentary. This was taken from Alice Walker's book.
Mm-hmm.
Most people didn't read her book, even though it was a bestseller for a very long time. And I understand that animosity about that. Why is a white man directing black people in a film? You know, well, number one, Steven Spielberg was the only person in Hollywood that could do the film. No one else wanted to do it, and he, because of his power, he could get it done. And it was Quincy Jones that took the film to him. Okay, so that's why the white man directed the film.
Mm-hmm.
Steven also gave it the opportunity to a woman, Alice Walker, to write the film.
Mm-hmm.
But film writing, and she was the first one to admit that when she wrote the film script, it was horrible. It's a whole different artistry. So he got someone else to write it. And so the controversy with men, I'll go back to that, with black men, why are we projected this way? And I can I understand that now, because when I toured the film after it was released and I had the opportunity to tour it in Europe and Spain and, the Scandinavian countries, and people were asking, are black men really like that? And I thought, oh, my God,
mm-hmm.
No. But what have they seen? What have they seen? Now, remember, we didn't have the Spike Lees and John Singleton and all these other directors, the Tyler Perry movies.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the only thing they had really seen. And so I can understand it being important to show positive images. And we still have that same issue in our culture because black people are upset that Halle Berry gets the Oscar for fornicating with a white man.
Yeah, Monsters Ball.
Ball. And then why is it that Denzel Washington, all the wonderful work he's done,
mm-hmm.
he gets the Oscar for being a thug and a,
mm-hmm.
what was that?
Yeah,
was
Training
it?
Day. Yeah,
training
the police
day.
Officer, yeah.
And you start
mm-hmm.
to wonder, why is that? And now I hear people saying, oh, you know, why does Kerry Washington and Scandal have to be having affairs with the white man? And she was, I mean, I think, I haven't been following the storyline, but apparently there was a very attractive, handsome black man that she didn't have she broke up with, and they were upset about fat, and it becomes a racial thing. It becomes very personal. And it's too bad, because as writers and actors, we're just projecting the story.
Mm-hmm.
We're not, it's really kind of hard to do everything in a story. But like I said, at the same time, I understand. Why is it? Why can't we get Oscars in a different light? You have to wonder.
Well, you know, you just think about sort of, you know, who controls the industry. And, you know, we can go back to looking at, you know, your, you know, nomination for the Academy and the politicking around that, and how you personally had to get involved in that particular work to even be nominated.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Well, the studios don't support you, at least at that time. They don't support you in getting nominated. But
mm-hmm.
if you, as far as when I say support, you get the ads out and do those kind of things. But if you get nominated, then they rally behind you personally as the individual actors. Now, that's how it worked at that time. I can't say how it is today, but I would imagine it's pretty similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering, the actress that you were thinking about for Sounder.
Cicely Tyson.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
I am still memorizing lines, fans out there. But names, I see their faces and I think, oh my God, why? Please, Margaret, say that name. Don't embarrass yourself. But Cicely Tyson, who was my idol for so many years, and I'll tell you a little story about that.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, in the late 60s, she came to a workshop. And it was on a Saturday, and I didn't have an agent. I hadn't done anything in acting, not in film anyway. And in this workshop, there was a break. And I think it was at Lee Strasberg Studios. And it was a coffee break. And she was getting her coffee, and I looked at her, and I said, and she's just a teeny little thing, you know. And I said, you know, you have a mouth just like Cicely Tyson. And she looked at me and she says, I am Cicely Tyson. And I didn't know what to do. I was so embarrassed. I put my coffee down next to the coffee pot and I just walked away. So to this day, I try to be very gracious to people. If they come up to me and say, oh, you know, are you Shug Avery, whatever, because I know it takes a lot of courage sometimes to walk up to who you believe to be a celebrity and someone that you really idolize. And it's just, to me, it was just overwhelming for her to say, I am Tyson. And I know my mouth just fell open and I walked away. I didn't know what to say. Oh, boy. We have to laugh at ourselves. Fans, we have to laugh at ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, it's a lot of responsibility being a public person. You know, people recognize you. You can't hide when you go out.
They recognize me when I look my worst. I said, oh, God, I didn't put any makeup on. Yeah, I'm Shug. Okay.
Yeah.
But wow. It's a blessing. I mean, for people to recognize me, they say they recognize me by my voice. As soon as I speak, they know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because the film has aired so much. And some people have a copy of the film, and they play it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I remember I have a copy of the film and two copies of the book, and when the musical was making its way around the country, I went to see it, I think, three times. I took my classes. I teach at a community college. I took my classes to see it. We did a big group. And, and at that particular time, at the Black Theater here, Lorraine Hansberry, the union, Black Theater, we have a couple of others, but they're not union houses. they were doing a stage adaptation of Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye. Mm-hmm. So it was really great, you know, having that juxtaposition of work on the Bluest Eye on stage and the Color Purple on stage as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, wow, looking at those two characters, looking at those, you know, looking at Celie coming up and then looking at this child, you know, growing up in this really abusive family.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? Yeah, and how that warps your you know, psychological sense of self. And so, you know, you create these other people to live in because you can't live in yourself. It's too painful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I would have liked to have seen that.
Yeah, it was very well done. It was just... Yeah, I mean, it was the kind of play you have to go sit down afterwards, like,
oh, absolutely.
Or stand up. Whatever you weren't doing, you need to do it, because, like, ooh. Yeah, it's like, oh, I got to work this through my system.
Yeah.
You can't just go to bed, and everything is good. Like, no, these characters haunt you.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to seeing San Francisco State. I don't know. The last time I saw it,
mm-hmm.
there was so much new construction, I mean,
yeah.
buildings. Because it used to be a very open, big, open area.
Mm-hmm.
It was huge, but I think there's a building there now. And I'll never forget, it was back in, I guess it was 64, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe 65. We were all out on the lawn there, and the loudspeaker. It was a very foggy day, and the seagulls were flying very low. It was like a scary movie. And our principal at that time was announcing that JFK had been assassinated.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just a very still, ominous day. And very gloomy.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a lot of happy memories there, too. I'm anxious to go back, even though I won't see it when students are there, but I'd like to just walk around the campus and just remember
mm-hmm.
the old alma mater.
Right, yeah, because you were born on, your birthday was last month, January 20th. Happy
birthday.
Well,
you know, that's on the Internet. Don't believe everything you read there. I mean, I was doing a play, and all these people, it was in the month of January, I think
mm-hmm.
it was last couple of years ago, people were wishing me happy birthday. I'm wondering, why are they saying that? You know, my
mm-hmm.
birthday's April.
Oh,
so,
wow.
But I don't care. You know, as long as if the Internet has my year younger, me being younger, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
I get mad when they have me older.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I read a resume of mine on the Internet,
mm-hmm.
and they had me working in TV when blacks weren't even in TV. I mean, back in the 30s. I mean, saying, well, Jesus.
Oh, my goodness.
So you cannot believe everything that you read
mm-hmm.
on the Internet. Please don't.
Oh, no, I don't. That's why I always mention it to, you know, if I'm speaking to someone, and I'm happy when I get corrected if it's incorrect.
Yeah, that is incorrect. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, if people continue to wish me happy birthday in January, I'll know it's still out there.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, 1964, that was real pivotal. There was a whole lot happening in this country that year. People were sort of coming into themselves and speaking up and speaking out and being authentic.
Yeah.
I think about
yeah.
Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
You know, JFK was killed. Let's see, there was something happened legislatively. Let's see, we had the March on Washington in 1963, and then 1964 was the Civil Rights Act, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. My generation, we just really went through a lot, the Vietnam War.
Yes.
I mean, I remember I lost a classmate through, she was pregnant and she was just too embarrassed to tell her parents, and she went to this quack, and she died.
Oh, man.
I remember classmates running off to Canada to escape the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are things that just impacted so many lives. And now we're almost right back to where we started. I mean, that things that we fought for as far as pro-choice and all of that. I mean, if we don't fight for our right to choose, we're going to lose it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly correct.
I'm not condoning that mm-hmm. anyone should do anything, but I do say that we should not lose our right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
We should have the right to choose.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand politically why. No, I don't want to get off on that.
Yeah. So you were born in Magum, Oklahoma. Is that correct?
in Oklahoma. Uh-huh.
Okay, yeah. And then did you come out here to California when you were, you know, sort of a really young child?
My mother married to get away from Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And we migrated to San Diego. My father was in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up in San Diego.
Okay.
And went to school there. My high school alma mater there was Point Loma High.
Mhm. Yeah. But then for your for college, you came north. Is there a particular reason why you chose San Francisco
State?
Well,
I went to San Diego City College for 2 years because
okay.
I didn't have the money to go away right away.
Mhm.
And I didn't have a car, and my mother worked at Sharp Hospital. And she had to drive right by. I get someone calling me. And so I said, yeah, I don't have a car, so it makes sense for me to go to San Diego as opposed to San Diego State,
mm-hmm.
because then I would have had to take the bus. So I must say I've always been pretty logical. So... So I went there for 2 years, saved my money working part-time, and went on to San Francisco State. I was able to have bought a car, and I bought my little stereo set and a few little clothes, and I rented a room from a family near the college
mm-hmm.
and with my own private entrance and my little cooktop. And at that time, I could work part-time. I was at the phone company that I did. I worked part-time at the phone company, and my budget was $100 a month.
Hmm.
That was without a car note, but with gas and rent, the rent was only $45 a month. And, you know, at that time, you had with me in the teacher's program, I had a big cleaning bill, and the dress code, even for college at that time, was so different. We wore little heels and nylons, and the fabrics of the dresses that I wore were not washable. Didn't have all of that we have now. And so I had a cleaning bill. I didn't even pledge for a sorority because between nylons and the cleaning and those little expenses, I just didn't have the money. So a lot of things are different today, but like I said, that my budget was $100 a month. I mean, we don't even earn enough money, even though there's more money being made now. It doesn't cover the survival expenses
mm-hmm.
for today. Things have gotten so out of whack.
Wow, that's amazing. So did you choose San Francisco State because of the activism?
No, what happened was that my plan was to go to UC Berkeley.
Okay.
Excuse me. And then someone said, well, look, if you really want to get a job as a teacher right after school, which I had to once I graduated, I needed to work, get a position right away. They said, go to San Francisco State because it's known as a teacher's college, and that's why I went there. So I don't know what their rep is now, if they've expanded, or,
mm-hmm.
but I also know that they had a wonderful drama department,
yeah.
but I was never able to participate because the education classes were extremely long. There was one class, you got one unit for I think it was like 4 hours a week by the biology lab, and I was taking 20 and 21 units a semester so that I could get out on time. Because in the City College, I lost some units because I think I got a low grade in chemistry or something, and so I got behind with my units. So working part-time and carrying that load, I just couldn't participate in the drama department because you had to be able to go to rehearsals, and I was working in the evening, so I didn't have time for any of that. But, oh, I remember the drama department being extremely, just great. They had fabulous choreography for the musicals and these wonderful voices. Obviously, people had trained not only in dance but in vocal. It was great.
Yeah, you're being cast in the role as Shug, and I think it's really interesting that Shug has your real last name.
That's the way it was in the book.
Yeah, I know. That's pretty cool. You already had a relationship, I was reading, with Spielberg, because you had been in another one of his films, I believe. And so I was wondering, well, if you were busy preparing to be a teacher, How did you continue developing your artistic side? I mean, your singing and your acting. How did you do?
Well, what I did was I right away, as I said, I got hired right away. I mean, I think graduation was like college was in June, and in July I had an interview for a teaching position for Oakland.
Okay.
School district.
Mm-hmm.
And where I was hired and actually interviewed, I was at Anthony Chabot Elementary School. And it's right across the street. I can't say right across the street, but it's directly across from the Claremont Hotel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Claremont Hotel has this busy freeway a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
if you cross the freeway and went down the hill, there would be Anthony Chabot.
Okay.
And it was Dr. Wong who was the principal at that time, and he hired me, interviewed me. And then when I actually arrived in September, I found out that Dr. Wong was leaving. And what he did, he was also, I had been listening to him. I think he had a jazz show on the radio on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to listen to his jazz program, never knowing that he would be the one to interview me.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a feeling that this school had never had a black teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And he made it a point to hire a black teacher. So, now you remember this is the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, I don't know why I'm getting hoarse. I was welcomed. I never experienced any kind of racism or anything. But being the first black, I always just tried to do a fantastic job. And during that time, I taught first and second grade, but I was also studying voice and dance. And on the weekends, singing in not Marin County, but the east areas. I was singing with a little trio, and participating in community theater. I think what was it? There was one musical that I was in, and I was a part of the chorus and dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a job as a singing waitress. Now remember, this is all on the weekend. It's a singing waitress in San Francisco at a place called Crystal Lil.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just screw up the drink orders. Oh my God, it was awful. And because people would say they'd want gin and this or scotch and this and da 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 da. And then when I would go to give the order to the bartender, they wanted it in the order that they set up their drinks. So that's what was confusing. And then I would mess up the drinks, and then I'd have to go back, reorder. Well, they started charging me for those drinks, the Crystal Lil.
Mm-hmm.
I was winding up at the end of the week owing them money. So what I would start doing is when I knew the drinks were messed up, I would point to the piano player to, hey, call me up next to sing. So I would, he would say, next, Margaret's going to perform. And then they put the spotlight on me and I'd sing. And then everybody that I was about to serve would be smiling, and they didn't care that I'd screwed up their drinks. Give me a tip. So I really kind of learned how to survive. Hey, just endear the people, and they'll forgive you.
Oh, that's funny. Wow, that's interesting. So,
but to this day, I really am a good tipper for waiters and waitresses,
mm-hmm.
because it's not an easy job to be a good waitress. It's not easy.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, there are lay psychologists, sort of working in those positions when they're able to survive them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, being able to, deal with different types of personalities and, you know, keep things cordial and, you know, not let, you know, sort of disgruntled customers get under your skin and things like that.
You really have to be strong enough not to get caught up in reacting to
mm-hmm.
people.
Right.
And that's really almost in any profession. You know,
mm-hmm.
you've got to not allow yourself to always react.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, talk about, if you want to bring us to the point where your teaching career ended because your weekends ended up being able to pay your bills. I don't know what film or what job that was. And then I wanted you to segue into, talking about your current role as Helen Patterson, playing opposite
okay.
Richard Roundtree.
All right, well,
mm-hmm.
what happened was that after teaching 3 years in North Oakland at I made the tough decision to move to Los Angeles because I knew I wanted to act,
mm-hmm.
and I figured it's either New York or San Francisco, New York or Los Angeles. So New York for stage and Los Angeles for film, and I figured, well, if I'm going to be a starving artist, I'd rather be where it's warmer. So once again, I had the skills of teaching and that experience, so I was able to sign up as a sub
mm-hmm.
in Los Angeles, and I agreed to go to any school, any grade, and so because I had low seniority, so they sent me to the toughest schools and the most undesirable classrooms, and I just learned to take control of the class because I realized after about 3 days of being in these really tough, unruly classes that if I didn't take control, I wasn't going to get called to sub. So I got that under control, and that was like acting, you know, because I had to become really tough and mean. Kids, they try you as a sub. And then if they see that they can't get by you, then, you know, you've got control of the classroom. Or I get the one that was like the bully of the classroom. I get him to be one of my leaders, and everyone would follow him
mm-hmm.
or her. So I learned some psychology in that and in acting. And then right after that, the Blaxploitation film started up. And concurrently, TV commercials, because I went to a couple of agencies, but they said, well, you know, we just don't have need for your type, meaning, there are no blacks in commercials, you know. I kept being persistent, calling, because they kept saying, well, we're going to have our meetings and we'll decide, Well, they never did, but I kept calling and calling. And finally, one day, they said, we have an interview for you. And commercials had opened up for blacks. I think somebody discovered that blacks use toothpaste and deodorant and laundry detergent and all that stuff that everybody else uses. And so I was able to work in that field consistently enough to stop subbing.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, I was able to just focus totally on the acting. And from the blaxploitation films, when they dried up, they took those same scenarios into television scenarios, Streets of San Francisco, Kojak, all of those were using I always play the wife or the girlfriend whose husband or boyfriend got caught doing something illegal, and I learned to cry on cue and all of that. But what really propelled my TV career was a cameo role in Magnum Force,
mm-hmm.
Clint Eastwood's film. And from there on, it's like I would walk into a room for an interview, and it's like, oh, you worked with Clint. It's like, boom, I got the part just like that. And, of course, it didn't hurt that I was well-trained by that time. I'd been studying acting in Los Angeles also and doing free community theaters, so you learn to like, know your lines and study hard and be perfect. And in blaxploitation films, they didn't have money to film something take after take after take, the same thing. You had to, like, get it in one take. The only way you got it a second take, try at it, is because maybe sound, there was a difficulty, or, oh, the lighting man had a problem. And you would pray for those situations because you didn't get a chance to do it a second time otherwise. So by the time Color Purple rolled around, despite doing television, because television works really fast, too, you didn't get direction to television. The director says, okay, on this line, I want you to walk over here, and by here, I want you to have finished the line, and duh. So you've got to have some training to do that. And because I could do it, I worked all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I always tell people, know your craft. I mean, it's a lot of people get a break and a lucky break when they just start out, but the true test is longevity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and save your money.
Mm-hmm.
I say that. Don't, just because you made a lot of money. It's like I said in earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The motion picture home woman said, hey, you know, actors have like a 10-year run, if that long, and then they never qualify for the motion picture home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, talk about some of your more challenging and favorite characters, maybe three, and
more challenging what?
Characters, maybe three, you know, over your career, and of course, you know, need you to mention Shug and Avery, and then talk about Helen.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now I have short term memory. All right, let's do color. I always amaze it at our president because people give those long questions with, they're like four part questions. He doesn't write anything down,
mm-hmm.
and he goes 1, 2, 3, 4. He answers all of them. I'm thinking, my God, he never even wrote a note. But anyway, for Color Purple, that was certainly challenging because I gained 30 pounds at the request of Steven Spielberg, 30 pounds in a month.
Mm-hmm.
And that was through Body by Jake. He gave me, they came and worked me out 5 days a week for a half hour, just a half hour. And I had a special diet. And the reason for that was that Stephen wanted me to be physically visually between Oprah and Whoopi.
Mm-hmm.
Because Whoopi was really small at that time. Whoopi, if you're listening now, I'm not talking about you. I'm just saying that she was like really, really very thin.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first 2 weeks, It was just, oh my God! I said, oh, I didn't gain any weight, and then suddenly, boom. So when I saw our first scene that we shot in Color Purple, I'm wearing the red dress and sleeveless. To see my arms being buffed and my body, my torso being wider, I mean, it was like I saw that and just, I'm sure I had tears in my eyes because I didn't think I was going to make it. And then, of course, keeping the weight on when we went to North Carolina in all that heat. You see snow in a couple of scenes, but, honey, it was hot. We lost, not lost, but a couple of people in our crew passed out from heat exhaustion and had to go to the hospital. It was so hot. So, and that was a challenge. And learning all the songs perfectly. There were only, I think there were like, 10 songs that Q had given me to learn lip sync perfectly,
mm-hmm.
and we only shot like maybe three or four.
Uh-huh.
So I was always under the gun, but we all put ourselves under the gun because we wanted to be perfect for Alice Walker. We wanted her so much to love what we did. Another difficult role, I think, was one that I can't even remember the name of it, but it was a television show where I had, like, one line, like, every four pages, and to try to remember when to say the one line, oh, my God. I said, I'd rather have a five-page monologue than that. It was very difficult, and... anybody who thinks that one-liners are easy, you earn your money.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of anything else that was really that challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and well, then
maybe it should have been.
Yeah, maybe not challenging, just a role that, because I just think, you know, when you put on these different personas, just as a person who's, you know, watching or in the audience,
mm-hmm.
It seems that even you know, after the, you know, the film ends or the show, the season is not renewed, it seems like a little bit of these characters might stay with you. Or,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I was just wondering.
Well, that's true because I've been asked to do plays that were going to be during the holiday season, Christmas
mm-hmm.
and New Year's, and I've turned them down because I said, oh, I don't want to do a dark character during that time of the year because that's with my family all over the place, that's the time we get together. And I don't want to be down during that time. I want to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's how I work on the role. I mean, other actors may say, it's no big deal to them. But to me, it carries over. And also, I noticed that when I was doing plays and doing a lot of television on the side, If I was doing a dark character, it affected my interview for an entirely different character, because when you so submerge yourself into a personality or a character, for me it's hard, it's very difficult to not have that carry over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's real, right?
Right. Because it's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Takes
mm-hmm.
a lot out of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think about, you know, that you're like the heroine in The Color Purple, the film, the way you know, you come on as just being all of yourself, being fully embodied, you know, fault in everything. And that's something that these women, and maybe even outside, off the screen, you know, people don't necessarily occupy themselves, you know, like fill their bodies with all of themselves the way that mm-hmm. you feel that character on the screen. And you know, what a wonderful lesson, you know, for the Seeley character, and also, you know, who you know, who wanted to not be in her body, not be in her, who, you know, be there because it was so painful.
Absolutely.
I mean, oh my goodness. Yeah,
absolutely.
and then to see her rebirth, it was just so beautiful.
Absolutely, yes, and that's what we hope will happen for our abused women, you know.
Yes.
I've worked with them, and it's so hard to work with them in a shelter or somewhere and find that they wind up going back to the same situation, not really having, maybe feeling that they can survive on their own or, you know, it's complicated. It's a lot involved because they've got to be able to be financially secure as well as emotionally secure.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then, you know, sort of going back to... that was an interview, a pre-recorded interview with Margaret Avery, who plays Shug, Academy nominated multiple times for a role as Shug in The Color Purple. And I want to remind folks again that the she's going to be, looking for my details, she's going to be at a special Valentine's Day celebration of The Color Purple. She's going to be in conversation this Friday, February 14th. V-Day, or the day that women are rising worldwide and men too against violence against women. At 7:30, there's going to be a gala, which includes performances and documentary excerpt and an interview. And then at 8:45, there's going to be the screening of the film. And all of this is taking place at the Castro Theater venue, 429 Castro Street at Market in San Francisco. So it's going to be really fabulous, and you don't want to miss it. And I'm going to give you the information on how you get tickets. Tickets are available at ticketfly.com, and you can also get tickets there at the theater. And for information, you can call area code 415-863-0611. And speaking of violence against women, I have on the air the sister of a victim of police violence, Kayla Moore. A year ago, she was killed by the Berkeley police. Good morning, Maria. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm so happy you can join us to talk about, you know, what happened to your sister last year, just a year ago, when she was killed by Berkeley police. And, you know, she's a transgendered woman, and she was also suffering from schizophrenia, right?
Correct, yeah. Kayla, you know, growing up, it was always Xavier, but he changed his name to Kayla about 15 years ago and has always lived as a woman, a very full-figured woman. And, you know, over the years, you know, especially growing up, we realized that there were some mental health issues, and he was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenia. So, you know, as a family, we just rallied around her and did the best we could to support her.
Right, yeah, yeah. And you said, you know, that you grew up in Berkeley and you live right across the street from your grandparents. I bet that was really sweet. But your dad was a single parent. He raised you, right?
He did, yeah. He received custody of us when I was 2 and Xavier was about 5. And, you know, our mom had her own issues she was dealing with. So, you know, we were blessed to have our dad and truly blessed to have our grandparents right across the street. It was our second home. So we were very, very loved and taken care of, well taken care of.
Right. Yeah, so why don't you tell us what happened that day, February 12, 2013?
Well, on that day, my dad had taken Kayla to go grocery shopping. She loved to cook. You know, she's a full-figure woman. She loved to eat and loved to cook, and she had, you know, company over. So Dad took her to go grocery shopping, dropped her off around 1 or 2, kissed her on the forehead, said, "I love you." She said, "I love you back." And that was the last time he spoke to her. What transpired was she had been on medication before. And, you know, like most people, they don't like to take the medication. It makes them drowsy and not really function well. So she was off her medication for maybe a few days, but still very calm and rational. And, you know, there was nothing out of her, there was no unusual behavior at that time. Her roommate, she had a roommate at the time who felt that she needed medication. So according to what we've been able to understand from the police reports, the roommate, who's been a longtime friend of Kayla's for about 15 years as well, called the Berkeley police to see if they could do a 5150 evaluation. So all that means is that they want, you know, someone to come down with the ambulance and possibly take her to a hospital to get evaluated for medication. You know, and I think that part is important to understand, that there was no disturbance. You know, Kayla wasn't running up and down the hallways out of control. She wasn't a danger to other people. She wasn't suicidal. She was in her own fantasy world. You know, Kayla had a way of talking to other people. You know, I don't know if you've noticed schizophrenics in the, you know, general population. You know, they talk to themselves, they talk to their spirits or whatever. But, you know, Kayla would talk to her spirits around her, and she would be in her fantasy world. So the roommate felt that, you know, okay, let's see if we can get her medication so we, you know, we can better communicate with her. So at that point, the roommate called the police. And when they arrived, they didn't arrive with an ambulance, which is, you know, if you're going to 5150 someone, you have to have, you know, the ambulance there as well. They came, and the first thing they did was run a background check on the person who made the phone call, the one who was trying to get Kayla help. And it turned out that that person did have a warrant in San Francisco. So they immediately arrested that person. And they then received information about Kayla, was able to run her information, and there was a warrant in San Francisco that they were not able to confirm. It wasn't the correct date of birth. The information was not correct. So one of the officers specifically told the Officer Brown, who went up to see Kayla later, that this is not a valid warrant. So, you know, at that point, after they arrested the person that made the phone call, they went up to see Kayla. Kayla was in her living room, and she had her, you know, her little muumuu on and, you know, her hair up, and she answered the door. And, you know, they started to talk to her, and I think she was just confused. She didn't quite understand what was going on. And the officer didn't mention, oh, by the way, we're here to get you a medical evaluation. We're here to get you help. The first thing she said was, we're here to arrest you. You have a warrant. And, you know, in Kayla's mind, especially in her fantasy world, she has a direct line to the FBI, you know. So the rational thing for her to do was to call the FBI to get this all straightened out. You know, at that point, she went to turn to make the phone call, and that's when the officers grabbed her and forcibly, you know, put her on the ground. And, you know, Kayla, being a big girl, you're not going to take her down that easy. And she didn't understand what was happening. She was thrown to the ground. They both fell backwards on a futon. Backup was called, and eventually six cops laying on top of her, restraining her, you know, trying to get her handcuffed. And, you know, I can't imagine what she was going through at that time, not being able to breathe, not understanding why this was happening. So after a few minutes of struggle, they did get the handcuffs on her, and it was a few minutes later that they realized that she was not breathing. Yeah, so she stopped breathing. They turned her on her side, and, you know, the officers began chest compressions, and it was only then that she stopped breathing that they called the ambulance. So
After
she stopped breathing. So at that point, one of the officers did the chest compressions. Not one officer did the breaths. You know, when you do CPR, you do, you know, you clear the airway, you do the breathing and the chest compressions. And without that air to her brain, those precious minutes that they wasted, you know, could have saved her life. But not one person on the scene, not one of those officers did that. So
they would just press it, just but not giving her air.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know,
that's
part
useless.
Of me. Exactly. It is useless. And, you know, it makes me angry. It makes my dad angry. We, you know, within the, and it's all in the police report, you know, they refer to Kayla as it, you know.
Wow, really?
Yes, it's in there. It's in the report. And, you know, that just, it makes you think, you know, did they not want to touch her lips? Were they afraid because they thought they would catch something from it? I don't, you know, it's these things that run through your head as to why they wouldn't try their best to try to save someone. So, you know, we waited and waited for months to finally get the police report from Berkeley. And, you know, we were in the dark with the law. They didn't offer any information, no support. They didn't reach out to us. We had to reach out to them to demand information. And once I read the report, you know, it was the hardest thing I ever read. But I'm so glad I did, because it was an eye-opener. And I saw all the ways that this could have been prevented. And the fact that it's been a year and still nothing has happened. Nothing. You know, we, our family, we have a lawyer who will be filing the lawsuit this week. But, you know, what oversight do the police have? You know, they have the Police Review Commission, which, you know, it's sad to say, it's a useless, inept organization. Their hands are tied. They can't tell you anything. But they're the ones who's supposed to provide oversight over the police officers, you know. So it makes you wonder, you know, what's their agenda, and you know, that part is frustrating. Tonight at 7 o'clock, we will be doing a rally at the Police Review Commission meeting. They're supposed to have the findings of their investigation released, so we're hoping to hear what they have to say. You know, unfortunately, I don't think they will tell us anything, because every time we ask, that's all we get. Well, we're not allowed to say. We can't tell you, you know. So, you know, we'll see what happens. We would love for people to come out too. We're having a vigil in front of the Gaia building, which is the building Kayla was killed. And that's going to be at 6 o'clock, and then the Police Review Commission meeting will be at 7. So we're going to march there and demand answers, basically.
Right, yeah. The Gaia building is located at 2116 Austin Way, right above Shattuck Avenue.
That's correct,
in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And then the Police Review Commission meeting is a little further up in South Berkeley. I guess further down, going the other way. 2939 Ellis Street off of Ashby, also in Berkeley. And for the Berkeley Cop Watch, you can call 510-548-0425, or online you can visit them, berkeleycopwatch.org. And then on Facebook, there's a Justice for Kayla Moore page that you
Correct.
Can stay abreast of. Wow. That is more horrific than I thought. I didn't know they smothered her. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, can you imagine? That's almost 1,000 pounds of weight on one person.
Uh-huh.
And when you have someone who is obese and overweight, that it's like you said, it just smothers them. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't want to paint a picture that, you know, Kayla is a perfect person. She's not. She had her imperfections, but she was so loving. You know, Kayla was the life of the party. Whenever you went somewhere, she made it fun, and she had this sweet innocence about her, and she certainly did not deserve this.
Oh, no, not at all. And I was just thinking about, you know, she was living, you know, in the Gaia building, and the Gaia, you know, is the, in ancient Greek, you know, she's the goddess of the earth and the land.
And the,
you
know, and
wow.
and you know, Kayla was her own goddess too. You know, she was special, and you know, we all miss her every day, and we just want what's right for her. So, you know, there's also the People's Investigation Report. It can be found on the Kayla's Facebook page, Justice for Kayla, and this is a report that was done by, you know, Cop Watch, myself, and other members, and it's just a great report that details everything that happened, and it doesn't just place blame. It provides recommendations on how this can't, you know, this should not happen again. So, you know, one of those.
Why don't you share some of the report with us?
Yeah, so in the report, you know, we sort of detail the incidents and each officer involved and what they did and their role, but it's also about, you know, finding solutions, and one of those is, you know, maybe officers aren't the best responders to mentally ill people when they're in crisis. You know, Berkeley has mobile crisis, but it's only during business hours. So, you know, most people don't have their crisis, you know, during business hours. It's after hours, and you want someone there who's trained to talk to you, to de-escalate you, to get you help. And unfortunately, officers are not trained for this. You know, they have crisis intervention training, which, you know, unfortunately, out of 75 patrol officers, only 4 are crisis intervention trained. And none of them were there that night Kayla was killed. So, you know, that's one of the things that we're asking for is 24-hour, you know, 24/7 mobile crisis in Berkeley. And, you know, maybe, you know, something may come of that, but, you know, we have to find other solutions because, unfortunately, the police are not responding. And this, you know, Kayla's incident doesn't stand alone. There's so many more just like hers, you know. And unfortunately, it has to do when cops arrive at the scene, you know. So for me, let's just take them out of the equation and just put mental health professionals in there. You know, if it's a dangerous situation, yes, you can bring officers along, but let these trained professionals deal with people who are mentally ill. So, but it's all great information in the report. You know, I encourage people to read it. It's very good.
Mm-hmm. Right. Ah, wow. So,
yeah. And I just wanted
happened?
To say one.
Oh,
go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was wondering what happened to the roommate who sort of set off a string of events. I mean,
yeah,
so the roommate was waiting downstairs for the police to arrive, and then they just unceremoniously just arrested that person. So that she couldn't go upstairs and tell Kayla what she had done.
That person was it just so devastated. And, you know, he was there's actually 2 people. In the beginning, it was the roommate, and then Kayla actually had her caregiver there as well, which even makes it more disturbing. So the caregiver would come over every once in a while, and the person actually called the caregiver to come and, you know, to look after Kayla as well. So when the roommate went downstairs for the waiting for the police, like I said, they ran his background, put him in the cop car, and took him and arrested him. So he was taken to jail that night. And the caregiver was actually in the room with Kayla when the police were there. They ordered the caregiver out of the room, which was something I never quite understood. Why would you – this is someone who is actually able to speak to Kayla to – you know, calm her down, but you order her out of the room, you know, that didn't make sense to me. So it kind of made me think maybe the police have their own agenda going in there, you know. You know, the guy building Berkeley is known to be diverse and multicultural, but the building maybe not so much. I think, you know, Kayla, I call her the trifecta. You know, she was black, she was transgender, and she was mentally ill, and I think that put her on their radar. So, you know, there are so many ways the situation could have been de-escalated, and, you know, Berkeley did nothing to help it. So, you know, right now I don't know where the roommate is. We lost cause contact. He went to San Francisco, and we just haven't – we tried, you know, to search for him to get, you know, his statement and to find out what happened, but, you know, he's scared, and I don't blame him.
Yeah, wow. And it's so interesting you said that one of the officers told his colleagues that the warrant was not valid, yet they
That's
moved
right.
on it anyway.
Yeah, that was Officer Smith. And Officer Smith actually, you know, Kayla was previously 5150 before in Berkeley when she was living with our parents. Because we were so happy to get her in Berkeley because her hometown is San Francisco. So when, you know, she came back to Berkeley, we were like, finally, she's close by, we can take care of her. And her housing hadn't come in at that time, so she was staying with my parents. And at that time, she did have 2 crises in which mobile crisis was called. They came. They're wonderful. They took care of her. They walked her right into that little ambulance, and she sat down, and she went to the hospital, got medication. So, you know, we thought, you know, being in Berkeley would be a lot better for her, but it turned out that it just made her more of a target, I think, for police.
Wow. How long has she been in Berkeley when this tragedy happened?
She was in Berkeley about 6 months at that time. And what Officer Smith actually was there.
Uh-huh.
Yes,
uh-huh.
And Officer Smith was there during one of her previous 5150s. So all of these officers had knowledge of Kayla, knowledge of her mental illness. You know, Officer Brown, the one who initiated everything and caused this, was the actually did a welfare check on Kayla a few months before that. You know, because when we don't hear from Kayla for a couple of days, we get worried. So we called the police and said, look, she's mentally ill. We just want to check on her. And, you know, it's a normal welfare check that, you know, our parents do, like every so often when we don't hear from her. So Officer Brown responded to one of those. So they knew the situation that they were going into. And, you know, they chose to handle it totally the wrong way. So.
Oh, this is really strange.
It doesn't make any sense at all. And the more I read the report, I was like, oh, my goodness, because, you know, I didn't know what was going on at the time. They didn't release any information. I went in there with an open mind, and by the end of the report, I was like, oh, my God. I can't believe they did this. So, you know, there are some people out there who distrust cops. You know, I've never been one of those. I've been, you know, but in this situation, it was an eye opener. And, you know, Berkeley police dropped the ball, and then, you know, Kayla had to die for their mistakes.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned that she was 41, and her birthday is coming up, and yours is as well. When is her birthday?
April 17th, she'll be 42. Oh. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, and then the coroner's report, that was kind of a strange report.
The cause of death was listed as accidental overdose. And Kayla had taken some methamphetamines. And, you know, I'm not making excuses for Kayla at all. I just want to explain that most people, especially schizophrenics, they're dual diagnosis, which means you can't just have mental illness. Sometimes you have a substance abuse issue that goes along with it. You know, most people who are mentally ill will turn to drugs. It's just a way of kind of dealing with what's going on. And they said that there was toxic levels in her system, but not lethal levels. And I don't think it takes a chemist or a scientist to know that it wasn't the methamphetamines that killed her, it was the struggle. You know, if something were to happen to Kayla that night, if she were to OD, we would have been devastated, but we would have understood to a certain extent. But that's not what happened. She didn't overdose. You know, she was smothered. It was positional asphyxia. And to say that, okay, she was obese and she had an enlarged heart and she was on methamphetamines, it was obviously her fault. It's disgusting to hear that, you know, for them to just turn around and take no accountability and then blame the victim.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at, you know, some of the reports from last year showing a reading from the Crime and Courts by Andy Nguyen, and he writes that one of the meetings, they asked the commissioner chair, Karan Shenoy, about whether the coroner's report would be released. Berkeley Police Department Captain Cynthia Harris responded that the department was still waiting on it and that there were not any new developments regarding the investigation. And then it says that a man who identified himself simply as Nate interrupted the meeting several times to ask if any officers were placed on leave as a result of your sister's death. He also claimed that Shenoy didn't care about the incident. He's quoting, he says, she was ugly and she was a drug addict, so she didn't matter. I really don't think you care that someone is dead. Were you at that meeting when this person?
Unfortunately, I was. I'm glad I was not at that meeting, but I did hear about that, and you know that would have enraged me. And that's, you know, when that's the kind of attitude that Kayla has had to deal with her whole life. So you know, it doesn't surprise me. It upsets me, but I'm not surprised that someone would say that. And you know, there were
this person is saying that the commissioner said this, you know, about, you know, that was, you know, he externalized those thoughts, you know, with regards to how slow was taking the department to get the information out to, you know, to you, you know, the family about what happened. And you say it's a whole year later, and here it is, you know, the review board is going to be having, you know, this releasing of this documentation, which might not be any new information, but definitely might not have an admission of guilt and policy change.
Yeah, and then to just let you know, the officers were not placed on leave. You know, they only do that if someone is shot. So there was no internal investigation by the Oakland Police or the Berkeley Police or the District Attorney's Office, because it wasn't considered a shooting. So, you know, there was no discipline for these officers at all. I doubt there were any policy changes. You know, the last policies that we asked for them was from 2011. So, you know, and in terms of getting the coroner's report, the Chief Meehan, Michael Meehan, sat in the one of the Police Review Commission meetings and lied to our faces. He said, well, we have no control over that. We can't control, you know, that's the coroner's office. You know, the coroner's office is Alameda County. They do have control over it, and he actually had them put a hold on the report for about 3 months. So, you know, it just, once again, it's another red flag. You know, if you feel as though your officers did everything right, why are you hiding this information? You know, why are you, you know, putting a hold on the coroner's report and not releasing it? You know, and honestly, last year in May, when we went to the city council meeting, we had to disrupt the meeting. 2 days later, the report finally came out, but we shouldn't have to go to that level, to that extent, for a family to know what happened to their loved one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it just makes you wonder, why did they hold on to that report so long?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Wow, you know, this is really, really sad. And as you mentioned, it's not the first time that someone with mental illness, you know, was killed by the people that were supposedly called to help them get assistance, you know, aid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope, you know, this, you know, it takes this to create change. Maybe something good will come out of Kayla's death, but change needs to happen. You know, I think, you know, like, once again, we were so happy to have Kayla in Berkeley again, and to see the results of what happened within 6 or 7 months is heartbreaking. So, you know, definitely if people can come out and support, we don't want this to just fade away. You know, they want it to fade away, but we want this to create change. We want policy change. We want these officers disciplined or fired, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have there been any such instances after Kayla was killed in custody? People with mental illness. Has anything happened since then that you know of?
Well, there's a few incidences that I've heard where they're trying to kind of put out this better image of themselves. You know, you'll hear a story, oh, yeah, we responded to a mental health call, and the guy had a knife, but we got the knife from, you know, it's like little things like that they're trying to make better. But, you know, it's still happening. Just the other day we had a gentleman come to Cop Watch just terrified. He had been arrested, and they thought that he was mentally ill, and he described his experience being in the jail at Berkeley, and he called it the dungeon, and that people who were mentally ill were being ignored. They were, you know, in these cells, and they were just being talked down to. They needed help. They were crying. They were, you know, ignored. So, you know, there's, you know, and this is someone's firsthand experience who is still traumatized by that, you know. So things are still happening that no one really knows about because it's not getting media attention. But it is happening. And, you know, and Berkeley is just a small little portion of what's going on out in the world. It's happening on larger areas, too. On February 13th, we'll be going to Clay Street in Oakland to kind of have Kamala Harris, you know, prosecute cops who kill. And, you know, from there you'll see and you'll talk to families where this just happens all too often. And something has to be done. Cops aren't being held accountable, you know, unless you have a camera and you're lucky enough to film it. It's very rare that they, you know, cops actually are prosecuted for this. But, you know, we will not stop. You know, this is a lifelong struggle and mission for me. And, yeah, so.
Right. Yeah, you sent me these really lovely pictures of Kayla holding her niece.
She loved her niece. Yeah, so that was.
Yeah, those are really beautiful photos. Yeah. So. What's happening on the 13th, you mentioned, in Oakland?
Right. It was part of October 22nd rally. It's being held by the Alan Buford Foundation, I want to say.
Oh, Alan Buford, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just something that needs more attention. And Kamala Harris, you know, we're kind of putting her in the spotlight because, you know, it's her job to make sure these cops are disciplined and to see that, you know, if cops break the law, they have to pay the consequences just like any other person. So we're hoping that, you know, she will take action or at least hear us, you know, power in numbers, I say. So the more people that can come out, the better. And, you know, and family members will get their opportunity to speak and tell their stories as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, here it is. Do your job, prosecute killer cops.
Right.
Yeah, let me get the details on that, people who are interested in joining you. Let's see. 3 o'clock Thursday. Oh, California Families Unite to Speak Out. It's going to be at the State Building in Oakland, 1515 Clay Street. And, yes, initiated, as you mentioned, by the Justice for Alan Buford Coalition. And, there's Justice for Alan Buford. And there's the number four, at gmail.com for information. Okay, so, that's going to be great. She's known for taking action, so that's going to be excellent. Elaine Brown is going to speak. She's former head of the Black Panthers in Oakland. Dan Siegel, representing the Bluefords in the wrongful death lawsuit against the Oakland Police Department, and yourself and your family, right?
Correct, yeah. We'll be there. Yeah.
Oh, that's excellent. Oh, that's really great. Yeah, it's really, really unfortunate that there's such a fraternity of victims, families, victims of police, you know, violence and brutality. And usually the police don't just beat you, they kill you. So it's
they
not
kill
like,
you, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like because they use excessive force. I mean, if you pull out your gun and you're a police officer, every now and then you maybe see people walk away or crawl away. But for the most part, if a person is a person of color, particularly black, you don't live to tell anybody any stories about what happened to you.
That's right. Yeah, you're dead, and that's it.
Yeah.
And and they control what happens after that. So, you know, I think families and people just need to unite and come together just and continue this fight. It really is. Something has to change.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah, there's a whole lot happening, you know, this week around sort of, you know, police accountability and the government's accountability in, you know, wrongful deaths, you know, wrongful incarceration, and just an abuse of power, which is really great, you know, because things change when we come together.
It's true, and I think the public and people just have had enough, you know, something has got to change and give. So, you know, the more we can organize and get together, the better and stronger we'll be.
Certainly, certainly.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Maria, and certainly have my condolences. And hopefully, you know, the next time we have you on, you can talk about, you know, victories, you know, around Kayla's unfortunate, you know, killing at the hands of the Berkeley police. And since, you know, they were all familiar with her, particularly two of the officers, you know, you know, this really, it was uncalled for. I mean, okay,
correct.
They get a call at 11 p.m., you know, it's past the hours, you say, where they have the friendlier folks come out. But like you said, people, you know, go into crisis, you know, after 5, and, you know, you can look at the emergency rooms to see that that's the case.
It happens, yeah, a lot.
Yeah, yeah, and police are often the first responders, and then maybe the fire department, and then the ambulance.
And then
so,
the ambulance.
Yeah. So if they're the first responders, which, you know, like you said, it's really unfortunate for your sister and unfortunate for a lot of people because they don't have the training. But these folks, they had no excuse.
Right.
None at all.
No, I agree.
Because they knew better. They had experience.
They had prior knowledge, and they knew what they were getting into. So
exactly, yeah. And if they couldn't handle it, they should have just stayed downstairs.
Yeah.
Until the ambulance came.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. Wow. And thank you so much for having me on and being able to express this. It's been kind of bottled up for a while, so I do appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a whole year. You know, your sister, you know, your beloved sister is, you know, it's like, wow, she's not with you.
I know.
You all are really close. I mean, she's just 2 years older than you.
Exactly, yeah. Man,
yeah. Well, certainly you have my sympathy and my prayers, and certainly I'm looking that you get justice, you know, that these police officers are held accountable and fired and imprisoned.
Yes.
that was like straight up murder.
Yeah, definitely. So I'll definitely keep you updated as to what happens tonight. Hopefully something, I'm still going to be positive and think something good will happen tonight, but we'll just see what happens.
Yeah, and tomorrow, you know, it's really great you're going to be able to talk to Kamala Harris.
Yes, because
she can make stuff happen.
Yeah, you know, and I'm hoping, I'm hoping she does, yes.
Yeah, me too. All right, well, you take good care, and
you
I might
too.
See you tomorrow. I'm not going to be able to make it tonight. They're having another gathering of families of incarcerated prisoners. They had a big speak out. Yesterday in Sacramento, and today they're having a gathering at Delancey Street Theater tonight around the same time as the Police Review Board Review Commission meeting in Berkeley. That you're going to be, I think it's like it's about the same time almost exactly. So I already had a prior commitment to attend that. But it's all the same story, you know?
Exactly, it is. So, yeah, I'll share what happens. And
certainly.
All right.
Well, you take good care, and thank you so much. And, you know, I know this is a sad day for you and your family and Kayla's friends.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. You're welcome. Right. You take good care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Peace and blessings. Bye-bye. that was Maria Moore, sister of Kayla Moore, who was killed, you know, smothered by the Berkeley police in a call for assistance, you know, a medical call, and Kayla Moore, you know, died in custody. Really, really unfortunate, really sad. So I'm going to play, I think I'm feeling like Whitney Houston, I Am Every Woman. I'm going to play that, and then give you a couple of more announcements, and I think that'll be it for this morning's show. Yes. Yeah, Kayla Moore. I am Every Woman, killed a year ago by the Berkeley police. And she lived at the Gaia Building in Berkeley. And so tonight, definitely folks who are able should get out and support the family, but also support, you know, justice by speaking out specifically at the Police Review Commission meeting at 7 p.m. at the South Berkeley Senior Center, 2939 Ellis Street off of Ashby Avenue in Berkeley. And for information for the Berkeley Cop Watch, call 510-548-0425 or visit berkeleycopwatch.org. And on Facebook, Justice for Kayla Moore, you can read that People's report that Maria mentioned that goes into a lot of detail about what happened that evening and what hasn't been said about the culpability of the police that responded to the call. And tomorrow at the State Building, 1515 Clay Street in downtown Oakland, Justice for Alan Bluford Coalition is going to be holding a speak out and to talk to the Attorney General about what's been going on with these killer cops, that they should be prosecuted and found responsible for, you know, their misuse of force and with regards to citizens. You know, Alan Bluford was killed by an Oakland police officer. My nephew, Opetaye, was killed by Oakland police. And that case is still open, and Alan Bluford's case is still open. And in both cases, the police have not been prosecuted or dismissed. They're still working. So that's a really important rally and gathering. And that's 3 p.m. tomorrow. Tomorrow is the 13th at the State Building, 1515 Clay Street. And then tonight there is a rally at the Guy Building where Kayla lived, and that is at 6 p.m. And then folks are going to go over to the South Berkeley Senior Center for the Speak Out at the Police Review Commission meeting. So the rally and vigil for Kayla is tonight, February 12th at 6 p.m. at the Gaia Building, 2116 Alston Way in Berkeley. And I want to mention another event that's happening this evening for those who are in San Francisco. Amnesty International has become an active player in the legal and moral fight against expanded and extended use of solitary confinement, which has been shown to be cruel and unusual punishment. And through research and advocacy, they have campaigned to end this abusive practice in California, Illinois, Louisiana, and Arizona. Tessa Murphy, campaigner on the United States research team in the Amnesty International Secretariat in London, and was part of the delegation that toured California's SHU and put together a report on the findings, will be coming out to California for this hearing. She is here, actually. And she asked if Angola 3, Free Angola 3 Coalition, could introduce her to their extended family and to individuals who have been in solitary confinement for lengthy periods of time and families of prisoners. So there is an informal gathering with light refreshments this evening at 6 p.m. at the Southwest Room at the Delancey Street restaurant. So Delancey Street is at 600 the Embarcadero in San Francisco. So I just wanted to let you know about that if you are in San Francisco and available. So I think that's it for me right at the moment. I was thinking about, President Lincoln. Today is his birthday, and this weekend is what's known as President's Day. And it's kind of ironic that the beginning of this long weekend would begin on Valentine's Day, which is V-Day, day to recognize the violence against women, and, you know, in Kayla's case, you know, certainly an instance of violence against a woman, and because, you know, she's transgendered, so she's a woman, you know, born as a man, but, you know, lived as a woman. And so I'm really happy that we're talking about, you know, Kayla and what she represents, and you know, the whole instance of a mental illness and our society's inadequate preparation for those who are in the public sector, inadequate preparation to treat and to assist people that have mental illness. You know, it's not something that should be looked upon, you know, with fright. And people who are mentally ill, you know, are our sisters and our brothers, and are, you know, mental illness is just like other types of illnesses, and people need to have training, particularly those who are first responders, because, you know, when someone is in crisis, they are not necessarily in control. But it sounds like Kayla was not a threat, and the officers, you know, this escalated the behavior by their behavior, and I certainly hope that the family gets justice for their departed loved one. So I am going to close out with some music, and I was looking at Marsha Tremell, one of my favorite drummers, and he's got this piece. It's a solo piece, drum piece. It's called Vernacular Talk. And, talking in the vernacular, speaking so that people understand you. So we're going to play that, and then if we have some more time, I might play a couple of other pieces. Thank you. Tramiel and the piece. The piece is called, I believe the piece is called Slipping, and it's on Vanak Hawk. And I'm going to play a piece by Malik Mikleet Hadaro, and it's entitled Walls. And I think that's kind of apropos since we're talking about justice and how justice is not being served to majority populations here in California, not to mention the United States of America. You know, we've got all these walls that are sort of blocking it.
Be gentle. Be gentle with me. I feel a fragile this year, be gentle with me, and the walls, this walls, I counted 10,000 walls around my heart now, can't see my eye walls, my walls. Some are made of cardboard and some are made of clay. Some are made of memories of that sad, sad day. Oh, I know every single one of my walls, my walls. Oh, I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of them. I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of my eye. Oh, 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 I, oh, 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 I. Some hold bones like graveyard stones, like fossils in the sea. Well, some are painted red for mystic me. Well, thank you. Well, I wanna have the flower grow in the sideways outer crack. And one day that plant may grow a hole in that wall, will crumble, 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 crumble. Lay up here and disappear. There's one that knows when you're not here. It's when I miss you that I see right through that wall. But when you're mortar and mud, oh, why do you do this to me? Can a water have roots or branches like a tree? Well, I don't know how deep this goes. You got to tell me, tell me.
We're going to close the show with Michael White's The Blessing Song. We're sending blessings of peace and prosperity and justice to all the families who are victims of state violence. Municipalities like Berkeley, Oakland, New Orleans, Chicago, New York, San Francisco.